As the inaugural Poet Laureate of Belfast, Sinead Morrissey is well aware of the great Irish poets who have gone before.
The tradition is so strong and so diverse and so exciting. People ask me all the time, do you feel overburdened or in shadow of the great luminaries of the generations before you? But I don't feel like that. I feel, for the most part, hugely grateful to be sharing a language with these people.
Sinead Morrissey also reveals how she's been influenced by American culture, from the writings of Robert Frost and Raymond Chandler to HBO TV productions and her husband, who hails from Arizona. We'll hear poetry from the most recent of her 5 award-winning books in the second half of our conversation for New Letters on the Air, produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. In part one of this interview, Sinead Morrissey talked about leaving behind her early fascination with the poet Sylvia Plath, along with what she called the juvenilia in her Patrick Kavanaugh Poetry Award-winning collection. She even turned down publication for that first manuscript. Now she's pared down her 5 books published by Carcanet Press in the UK even further for the American audience, with Parallax and Selected Poems, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in 2015. That's the year I interviewed her when she was a guest of New Letters Magazine and Kansas City's Irish Center, visiting from Queen's University and the Seamus Heaney Poetry Center in Belfast. We heard from her early books in the first half of our conversation, so we'll pick up with poetry from her 3rd publication, The State of the Prisons. A professed lover of poetic forms, here's a favorite one from Sinead Morrissey.
Well, as Elizabeth Bishop once said, this is my one and only villanelle. Genetics. My father's in my fingers, but my mother's in my palms. I lift them up and look at them with pleasure. I know my parents made me by my hands. They may have been repelled to separate lands, to separate hemispheres, may sleep with other lovers, but in me they touch where fingers link to palms. With nothing left of their togetherness but friends who quarry for their image by a river. At least I know their marriage by my hands. I shape a chapel where a steeple stands. And when I turn it over, my father's by my fingers, my mother's by my palms, demure before a priest reciting psalms. My body is their marriage register. I reenact their wedding with my hands. So take me with you. Take up the skin's demands for mirroring in bodies of the future. I'll bequeath my fingers if you bequeath your palms. We know our parents make us by our hands.
I could see that you were reciting that from memory, so this is one you recite quite a bit. It's a beautiful villanelle. That was the poem Genetics, which was originally included in Sinead Morrissey's 3rd book, The State of the Prisons, but is now in Parallax and Selected Poems, her first book published here in the United States by Farrow Straus Giroux. Did it come to you right away as a villanelle?
Yes. Yes, it did. I'd had several failed attempts at writing a villanelle. I'd only recently found out what a villanelle was. A friend of mine, Justin Quinn, had written a number of poems that were in this crazy shape. And I was looking at them going, hang on a minute, these lines repeat and the B line rhymes. And oh, what? It seemed unnecessarily intricate and I failed a lot. But I had internalized the structure of a villanelle by my failures to write one. And then I was looking at my hands one day, and my father has these long, skinny fingers, which I do, and my mother has these square palms. So I just thought, oh, look. As soon as I had that thought, and I thought I was going to write a poem about it, when I got the line, my father's in my fingers, but my mother's in my palms, then I knew it was a villanelle. And it wrote itself quite easily once I started. For me, there always has to be a dynamic relationship between the form of a poem and the content of a poem. And I was thinking afterwards, well, why was that poem a villanelle? And I was sort of after the fact, you know, rationalizing it. And this wasn't conscious at all, but I do think there's something about the genetic strands, the shape of the genome, the way genes work through the generations as a kind of repeated line of the villanelle with slight alterations as it falls down through the poem. So I do actually think that...
it's like a genetic chain.
Yeah, there is an absolute reason why that particular poem had to be a villanelle.
Yeah, that image. And you're right, the villanelle is perfect for that. So you're never going to write another one?
I don't know.
It has to pose
itself. It has to inherently be a villanelle in the same way that that one was. I don't think there's that many villanelles out there in the world waiting to be written.
I know. I think it's really hard. You're not the first poet who've said my first and only villanelle. Mm. I mean,
I think I was very lucky to even get one. I mean, when they work, they are
fabulous.
They are fabulous. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that I enjoy that you do throughout your poetry, you refer to other poets throughout. For instance, driving alone on a snowy evening after frost. And of course, all of us in this country know Stopping by the Woods.
All of us in my country know Stopping by the Woods as well. It's the first poem that I ever heard. My primary school teacher brought it in and made us learn it.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Your mm-hmm. very first poem. Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that your grandmother introduced you to poetry.
Yeah, she used to recite poetry. She used to recite The Highwayman, and Daffodils by Wordsworth were her two poems. But I experienced those as kinds of bits of extraordinary language that she would say. But my kind of first understanding of a poem by having to learn the whole thing was Stopping by Woods on a snowy evening.
Right. Mm-hmm. Would you like to read that poem?
Sure. Driving alone on a snowy evening after frost. There is no reason that I know to go on waking, eating, so I turn the urgent wipers off and watch the screen sift up with snow. They'll conjure emptiness, despair, disease in the wings, a failed career. Those inward ticking moments when the seduction of stopping obliterates fear. The car purrs on. I do not brake. The choice of crash I leave to fate. A tree, a bridge, a railway line. Behind the brightness, dark shapes wait. The snow and ceiling kiss, then meet. The view's as white as a winding sheet. The heart still beats. Repeat, repeat. The heart still beats. Repeat, repeat.
Driving alone on a snowy evening, included in Sinead Morrissey's The State of the Prisons, which is her third book and won the Michael Hartnett Poetry Prize in 2005. You're listening right now to New Letters on the Air. I hear rings of frost throughout that, which is really fun. You like doing that. I caught allusions to Philip Larkin here and there throughout your work, too.
So. I think I can't write without reading. It's about having a conversation with poems. So it's sort of inevitable that people end up in there as well.
Yeah. And you're part of the Seamus Heaney Center for Poetry.
Yes. It's connected to the School of English at Queen's, and it's the kind of center for poetry, criticism, and creative writing.
Was there a great deal of mourning when Seamus Heaney passed away?
Yes, absolutely. Seamus Heaney got what is the closest you can get to a state funeral in Ireland without it actually being a state funeral. That's the thing about Seamus Heaney. He belonged to everybody. So the whole island, north and south, was united in mourning. It was a huge outpouring of not only grief, but love and reverence for him and for the work.
There was here even.
Mm, you know. I know, it was all over the world.
Yeah.
And people say poetry's dead and nobody reads it. And it's just not true.
It's not true.
It's very vibrant and very relevant to very many people all over the world.
Before we leave The State of the Prisons, I have to have you read Reading the Greats.
Okay. This is a kind of tongue-in-cheek poem.
Well, I think it shows your sense of humor. So. I love your description here. They dip, trip up, run out, there is something fun about poetry that way. And yet, it sounds like you might not be so thrilled with looking back over your poems where you dip, trip.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I dip, trip, run. I did much more than they ever did. But the point of that poem is the tide comes back. You know, the tide goes out and then the tide comes back. So it's taking consolation from the fact that the tide comes back.
Yeah.
Reading the greats. Is it for their failures that I love them? Ignoring the regulation of selected poems with everything in that should be in, all belted and buttoned and shining, I opt instead for omnivorous completes, for their froth, their spite, for avoidable mistakes. Larkin on empire, say, or Plath on ants. The thrill of when they dip, trip up, run out of things to write about before they start, is the consolation of watching a seascape suddenly drained and stinking of flies and fish heads and bladder rack, and the tide impossibly distant and no way back. Yes, I love them for that.
Reading the Greats, which is also included in Sinead Morrissey's first book published in the U.S. called Parallax and Selected Poems. This is New Letters on the Air. That's really fun. And it pulls together people we've been talking about today. So. I want to have you read something from Through the Square Window.
Okay. Which one is it?
The title poem,
yes,
Through the Square
Window.
Because this one won first place in the UK National Poetry Competition. Is that why you decided to name the book this too? Or did that competition happen before?
Yeah, it won before I'd finished the book. Or maybe I'd finished the book and the poem had won, but I hadn't decided on a title yet.
But it's so apt for you before
absolutely.
Looking at
no, it. No, this is absolutely, whether it had won or not, this is absolutely the correct title for this collection.
It is. It really works well, I think.
Through the Square Window. In my dream, the dead have arrived to wash the windows of my house. There are no blinds to shut them out with. The clouds above the lock are stacked like the clouds are stacked above Delft. They have the glutted look of clouds over water. The heads of the dead are huge. I wonder if it's my son thereafter, his effortless breath, his ribbon of years. But he sleeps on, unregarded, in his cot, inured, it would seem, quite naturally, to the sluicing and battering and paring back of glass that delivers this shining exterior. One blue boy holds a rag in his teeth between panes like a conjurer. And then, as suddenly as they came, they go. And there is a horizon from which only the clouds stare in. The massed canopies of Hazelbank, the severed tip of the Strangford Peninsula, and a density in the room I find it difficult to breathe in until I wake, flat on my back, with a cork in my mouth, bottle stoppered, in fact, like a herbalist's cure for dropsy.
That's Through the Square Window, which is the title poem of Sinead Morrissey's fourth collection. The poem itself won the British National Poetry Competition first place, and then the book won the Poetry Now Award in 2010. All of your books have won awards. That's kind of incredible.
It's kind of terrifying. Whatever am I going to do next? The end of the line.
Yeah,
I know. It's just been a very blessed career so far.
Well, you know, one of the big awards is the T.S. Eliot Prize, which you have been shortlisted for on several of your books.
Yeah, I was shortlisted 4 times in total.
Yes.
So they gave it to me out of pity, I think, fourth time round.
Anyway, your fifth collection won the prize in 2014.
Yes, I was awarded it in January 2014, but the prize was for the 2013 T.S. Eliot Prize. Yeah. So for the best collection published in Britain or Ireland in the year 2013.
So Parallax, winning that award, did that have anything to do with it being published in America?
I think it had everything to do with it being published in America.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's fabulous. So in this particular collection, this one too takes us different places. This is the one where we get to go to Arizona and Baltimore, I was thinking about, because we've been having so many troubles in Baltimore.
Absolutely.
But I wondered if you had some affinity for it, because Belfast has had a history of violence.
There's always going to be these simmering tensions between the two communities in Northern Ireland. Or maybe not always. Maybe that's too pessimistic. But maybe they're going to continue for the next while and hopefully peter out. But I think at the same time, it's really important not to lose sight of the fact that we have come vast distances in Northern Ireland.
Well, just the fact that Sinn Féin is now...
The extent to which we have a functioning parliament is debatable, but we do have devolved government and the city itself. I mean, the city of Belfast is unrecognisable from the city that I grew up in. And there are not bombs going off constantly and people are not constantly being shot. So there has been enormous progress, which is a fantastic thing. And there's a terrific vibrancy about the city of Belfast. In spite of these tensions and these difficulties, which are no doubt intractable, there is a great sense of flourishing, particularly in poetry, which is a really exciting thing to be around. I mean, Northern Ireland has always been an extraordinary place for poetry, or certainly it has since the last half or so of the 20th century, when we think of the great poets who have come out of that very, very small geographical area. But it continues. I mean, I work in Queen's University Belfast with young people for whom poetry is the absolute centre of their lives. And they are carrying the mantle. They will be the next poets and the readers of the future. And if they are anything to go by, then the future of poetry in Belfast is looking very bright indeed.
Why do you think poetry has got such a stronghold on that region?
I don't know the answer to that. maybe there's just something in the tap water. I think people often make the jump to say, you know, it's a place full of socio-political tensions and difficult history, and that is somehow fertile soil for poetic flowering. I'm not sure you can make such an easy correlation, but I do think that there is definitely something very positive to do with influence. People ask me all the time, do you feel sort of overburdened or in shadow of the great luminaries of the generations before you? But I don't feel like that. I feel, for the most part, hugely grateful to be sharing a language with these people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the tradition is so strong and so diverse and so exciting that that is what is nourishment for these young writers in the city.
What made you write a poem about Baltimore?
Well, it's really a poem about The Wire. Yeah. I've never been to Baltimore, but I have watched The Wire.
So you've been...
Everybody's watched The Wire at home. It's a complete phenomenon. Everybody's obsessed with The Wire. It was just this funny thing that I was aware, having had children, that when you put them to bed, you are hyper alert for any noise that's going to be coming from them potentially. I would literally hear my children crying and all these other noises when they were completely fast asleep and fine. But I think your levels of anxiety are so raised by parenthood. And then just after giving birth to my daughter, my second child, she wasn't going to bed at any regular time for a while. So we would put our son to bed and we would walk her up and down the living room and we would watch The Wire. So I thought it was a funny thing to introduce a baby to on lots of different is that kind of complex and very sad world in many ways, which is so brilliantly depicted through that television series. Yeah, so it was a poem about all those things.
How about we have you read Baltimore?
Okay. Baltimore. In other noises, I hear my children crying. In older children playing on the street past bedtime, their voices buoyant in the staggered light. Or in the baby next door, wakeful and petulant through two thin walls. or in the constant, freakish pitch of West Side Baltimore on the wire. Its sirens and rapid gunfire, its beleaguered cops haranguing kids as young as six for propping up the dealers on the corners, their swagger and spitfire speech. Or in the white space between radio stations when no voice comes at all and the crackling static might be swallowing whole a child's small call for help. Even in silence itself, its material loops and folds, enveloping a ghost cry, one I've made up but heard, that has me climbing the stairs, pausing in the hall, listening hard to at most rhythmical breathing, but more often than not to nothing. The air of the landing thick with something missed, dust motes, the overhang of blankets, a ship on the lock through the window. Infant sleep.
Baltimore, from Parallax, which is also included in Parallax and Selected Poems by Sinead Morrissey, published in the U.S. by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. This is New Letters on the Air. It just goes to show you there's roots for poetry everywhere. Mm. Everywhere. Well, how should we end this? I thought it might be kind of fun to end on a high note with The High Window.
Okay, sure.
And
yes,
because
that's
this
a fun poem.
Is that a good way to end?
Yeah, that's a great way to end. I was reading Raymond Chandler. I think I'd been a bit sniffy about Raymond Chandler earlier on in my life.
No, what do you mean by sniffy?
I just
holding
thought
your
it was,
nose up?
Yeah, I kind of thought it was...
Because he's a genre writer.
Yeah, it was genre fiction. I wasn't interested in detective stories. I was reading Dostoevsky or whatever, so... And then my husband bought me a copy of The High Window, and we have this thing where we read a book to each other at night. So we've read The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. And
he likes spy fiction.
Well, he just thought it might be fun to read this, but neither of us had read Raymond Chandler before. So we would take it in turns and read a chapter aloud each night. And we were both completely smitten by the brilliance of Raymond Chandler and those shining sentences and his brilliant imagery. And, you know, I think gender and race politics are very dubious, but the language is fantastic. So it was actually my husband, and he said, okay, well, I think you should kind of write a Raymond Chandler-like poem, but you should do it from the female perspective, because we always get the blonde walking into the office. So he said, turn that around and see what happens.
I love that your husband is involved with the creative process in some way.
Yeah,
and you don't feel threatened by it at all.
No,
you
I just feel
it.
Very grateful that he's interested, that he cares.
What does your husband do?
He's an acupuncturist.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
So I have a poem in The State of the Prisons, which is called The Yellow Emperor's Classic.
I remember that.
After Gongsun. And Gongsun is kind of the mythic founder of acupuncture in prehistory, going back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And the Yellow Emperor's Classic is this kind of mythological founding textbook of acupuncture. And when my husband was learning acupuncture, what fascinated me as a complete outsider was how the model of the body in that system is completely different to the model of the body in Western medicine. And if you think of them both as a map, they're probably both wildly inaccurate in completely different ways. All it was just too good to not try and write a poem. So I wrote this poem, which is pretending to be a found poem, but I just made it all up.
That's great. What does your husband think of that poem?
Oh, he really liked it. He's great because he's interested in so many things, so then I get interested in them. And he's also great at sort of tapping me on the shoulder and going, that's a poem, I want you to write that, that's a poem. So he gives me these brilliant ideas all the time.
Does he read other people's poetry?
Yeah, he does. I mean, he studied English. He's from Tucson, and he went to university in Tucson, and he studied English and age and religion, actually.
That's great. So sometimes he sees it before you
do. Frequently he sees it before.
Oh, wow. Has this been all along throughout your relationship?
Yeah. Wow. He's just got a really good sense of what I would like to write about or what might be fruitful for me.
Yeah.
So this is what happened. The High Window. Honey, You've requested a Raymond Chandler spin-off, a spoof in style, but from the blonde's perspective. Let's say the secretary in the one about the coin called a brasher doubloon gone missing from a Pasadena mansion. We're in this thing together, busier than a PI who never simply talks but utters wisecracks like a jeweller stringing pearls. Happier, too, more stranded in domestic detail. But hell, tonight I've drawn the blinds, clicked on the tasselled lamp, unplugged the telephone, set out two highballs, and before the children cry upstairs, pulled you down beside me by your tie. So I say, it's like this. Some guy walks into the office with an unlit cigarette, wearing unimpressed like a drip-cut jacket, and looks her over. He looks everything over. Plants, ashtrays, furniture, with a languid, expert eye. The type of man who gives a girl offence by offering advice about her gloves or hair or makeup uninvited. He knows too much about guns and broads and books and chess, the likelier scenarios, which kinda hurts his soul and which kinda makes him smooth and cool and powerful. Our glasses clink. Then you say, A-OK, but what's with her? And I don't know. Witchery in the garden room for sure. Towering flaxes pressed against the pane, an alcoholic mistress, and a life so narrow, probably from the outset, its pathetic little batch of dull effects could fit inside one suitcase. Which is not her fault. And you know what? Maybe hair pulled taut against her head and a simple linen dress, so weird he notes it twice, is just her choice. The whiskey seeps its spiced and easy heat along our spines. The house is oddly quiet, and I'm suddenly adrift in how the road to Idle Valley dips and curves towards its secret. A thousand lighted windows on the hill, a moon so sharp its shadows look cut out with an engraving tool, and Marlowe in his car, escaping the patrol. Now kiss me.
The High Window, from Sinead Morrissey's T.S. Eliot Prize-winning fifth collection, Parallax, from Carcanet Press. It's included in the U.S. publication by Farrar, Straus & Giroux called Parallax and Selected Poems, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in 2015, the year I talked with her when she was a guest of New Letters Magazine and the Kansas City Irish Center. When she was here, she was teaching at Queen's University in Belfast as part of the Seamus Heaney Poetry Center, but in 2017 she moved from Ireland to the UK to help start a poetry center at Newcastle University. If you'd like to hear the first half of this interview with Sinead Morrissey, visit our website newletters.org. While you're there, look through our audio archives that stretch back to 1977. We'll be featuring some favorite past shows over the next year as we kick off our 40th anniversary in April, which also happens to be National Poetry Month. Sign up for a free weekly podcast and follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Abby Jamison, Elizabeth Albano, Anju Christopher, Renita Johnson, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.